Good morning.
Good morning.
This morning, I'm going to keep talking about Shanti Deva's Guide to the Bodhisattva Way, Chapter 6 on Patience. We're on verse 12. The verse 12 is, the cause of happiness sometimes occur. The cause of happiness sometimes occur. Or occurs. But the causes for suffering are very many. Without suffering, there is no renunciation. Therefore, mind, you should stand firm. I read this interesting, in light of this, I read this interesting little section of a column today in the Wall Street Journal called Mental Tricks to Make Our Summer Days Last. Mental Tricks for Making Our Summer Days Last. By Laura Vanderkam. And here's what Laura had to say, the part I thought was interesting. Life in general, unfortunately, can be harder to enjoy. The brain's natural background state is negative. No one wants to get eaten by wild animals, so perhaps our ancestors did better loping around on constant high alert. We are primed to survey our surroundings for every sort of threat or possible source of unhappiness. Good stuff doesn't demand our attention in the same way. You have to seek it out. And Shanti Deva said in the 8th century, the cause of happiness sometimes occurs, but the cause of sufferings are very many. So let's talk about the causes of happiness and suffering. Undeniably, sometimes we are happy, but we're also sometimes unhappy, and we can't avoid experiencing suffering or unpleasant circumstances, because that's just the nature of what it is to be a human being in this life. Sometimes we're happy, sometimes we're unhappy. I don't know if Laura Vanderkam is... I'm not sure that I want to go along with this idea that we're hardwired to be unhappy. But we certainly do experience unhappiness. And that's what it is to be in this saha world, in this world of impermanence, essentially. Permanence and suffering. And happiness, and friendship, and love, and caring. All of those good things as well. And yet at the same time, I think sometimes we're temperamentally geared towards one side of the spectrum or another. Like we always say, we have the expression, your glass is half full, right? Or your glass is totally empty. So it's either half full or it's half empty. So, you know, how do we kind of fall in that spectrum? So I think it's important to kind of know that about ourselves. Are we somebody who's very optimistic all the time? Are we somebody who tends to go towards the more negative? Are we a person who feels restful in situations? Or are situations make us restless? Are we somebody who feels like we're deprived all the time? Are we feeling we're not getting enough? So that's that kind of half full, half empty mindset. You know, I'm probably a person who has a tendency to be the half-empty glass person. So, you know, I look at other people who are kind of naturally generous. There are people who are naturally generous. They have a kind of built-in gratitude. They're sort of this wondrous relationship to life. So I think that our teachings are that as we cultivate more and more gratitude for our lives. And I think that's something that we're all looking for as human beings. There are these constant self-help strategies, right? If you, at night, you've heard this one, right? You go to bed at night and you say to yourself the three things that you're most grateful for that day. This is guaranteed to make you a happier person. Do we do that? Some of you may do it. I'll do it for a week or so, and then I forget about it. But our practice essentially is to cultivate, this part of our practice is to cultivate this kind of gratitude. You know, this, and out of that generosity comes empathy for each other. It's much easier to be empathic towards each other when we feel a sense of gratitude for each other. We're grateful for each other, that we are amazed by the wondrousness of our lives. I like to make this joke about our minds. We have these absolutely amazing minds, which is a wonderful thing. And then it's also our minds that are the problem, right? So that we really cultivate this mindset of being in wonder of the amazement of our life. Be in wonder of how wounds heal, you know, how our lives, our bodies just heal themselves. Most of the time, our bodies have this wondrous ability to heal themselves. So we do a lot of studying about this kind of thing in our culture. And I think essentially because maybe we're unhappy. So we're always looking for ways to be happy. Often we're looking for them in the wrong places, I think. If I just got this thing, if I just lost weight, if I just took this right vitamin, if, you know, whatever it is, if I read the right self-help book, I went to the right workshop, whatever that is, somehow this activity, this way of looking at our lives is going to be a panacea for all of our suffering. It will be like a magic wand. I bet you if you go into a bookstore that there's probably more self-help books in a bookstore than any other category of books that we could read. So we're very interested in this, and I think that this is this deep desire that we have to become happy, to alleviate our suffering. That's really a wonderful thing, actually, that we kind of work so hard at that. That's the essential teaching of Buddhism, the Four Noble Truths, which is often called the first turning of the wheel. The Buddha said there is suffering, there is a cause of suffering, there is an end to suffering, and it's the Eightfold Path. So Buddhism, from the very beginning, is bringing forth this teaching of how do we, addressing this issue of how do we deal with the cause of our suffering. Some people say, oh, that's so negative, you know. To say, one translation of the Four Noble Truths is, life is suffering. Maybe a more appropriate translation is something like, there is suffering. Or there is dissatisfaction. That's another way to translate dukkha. There is dissatisfaction. So we all experience this dissatisfaction and this desire to make change. And that's what Shantideva is talking about here. And how we go about doing that from a Buddhist point of view. So often, despite all this effort, we're still suffering from our afflictive emotions. And we're unhappy. So that's our suffering. We're unhappy. You know, the older I get, the more I'm pretty sure that there are some afflictive emotions I'm dying with. They're not going to get fixed. I'm going to be struggling with this thing, whatever it might be, for the rest of my life. So why not make friends with it? Why not figure out a way to actually have some kind of joy and generosity around those issues that I have? Because it is the nature of human beings to, I think, to be caught in our afflictions. So this, again, this is the Saha world. And also, in the midst of this unhappiness, we try to find a reason for our unhappiness. We try to find meaning in our unhappiness. So in some ways, you could say that Buddhism is about finding a certain interpretation or meaning about the way that we suffer and to put a good spin on it. And I have to say, on a certain level, from looking at practice, why not? Why not look at it in a way? Why not look at our suffering as a source of wisdom? Why not look at our suffering as a way that we cultivate empathy for each other? You know, why not look at our suffering as a way that it connects us, that we have this deep intimacy with each other, that we understand this about each other? Why not use our suffering to cultivate generosity? Why not use our suffering to cultivate a kind of wondrousness of this world, of what it is to be a human being in this world, what it is to be conscious in this world, what it is to be aware of self in this world, what it is to be aware of other in this world? But often what we do is we tend to go to being, to blaming. I think that's another side. The other side of this is that we want to blame. So we want to find meaning, and we have to find meaning by blaming the other, because it's really hard to look at who we are as a person and to consider the possibility that what we're doing might be unskillful. So we want to not take any responsibility for our own emotions. And this is the tough teaching. I think I talked about this before. There's a Tibetan Lojong slogan, drive all blame into one, which is, I find to be such tough love. Drive all blame into one, because what it's saying is that if you want to blame, then look to yourself, because you're the one who's responsible for your reactions. Nobody makes us react a certain way. Causes and conditions in our lives may be such that we're pushed, you know, we're being pushed into a particular kind of response. Genetically, we might be predisposed to be pushed in a particular kind of response. But at the moment of our response, and this is a lot of what I think Dogen's talking about when we talk about the Dharma position, in this particular moment of your response, if we can come to that moment without all of our baggage, with a clear mind, we are immediately freed and liberated from that to do what is most skillful. That's enlightenment. That is like so hard to do. But that's when we say, I take responsibility for my actions, we are freed at that moment. We are liberated at that moment to create transformation. Because if we are always trapped, we are forced into a certain kind of response, and we can never be freed from that. So by thinking of our experiences as traps, our experiences as boundaries, our experiences as fixed and unchanging, at that point we trap ourselves into a certain kind of response. So to say drive all blame into one is not a kind of indictment of the self, although it feels that way, just taking that face value. But it's actually a slogan that liberates us from our own trap, the trap that we are creating. And of course, as human beings, and I don't know why, maybe it's societal, maybe it's the way we're hardwired, I don't know why, but we tend to go to that place. We tend to go to the place of getting caught in this accumulation, what Dogen in Uji calls piling up of our experiences. He's saying, if you can free yourself of this piling up, that's where the liberation and skillful means is. Now, the thing about this is, to my mind, is that we actually do this a lot, and we don't think about it, So we actually are freed a lot to just respond in this really helpful way. And there are other things that, what I said before, you know, I know that there are some afflictive emotions for myself that I'm going to die with. So we do our best to become aware of those, as Dogen says, traps and snares, to become aware of where it is that we get caught. So that when we are in that place of being caught, we can say, oh yeah, I'm caught. Not, I'm a bad person, or all the negative things, just, oh yeah, I'm caught. Now, I'm the one who can free myself. And I want to do, to try my best to do that. So there's this way that that's part of what our teaching is about, is let's, you know, let's get uncaught. So we make this effort to do this. So if we're unhappy, we might see everything as a problem. But a problem that we want to blame the other, or a problem that we want to blame ourselves about. But actually, if we just frame it as a problem that's workable, that is something we're curious about, that is something that we recognize is being really painful, recognize as causing suffering, and making it, as Trungpa Rinpoche would say, more spacious. This way in which we create space around the problem through curiosity and generosity. Does that make sense? This way, in, it's like breathing. It's like stopping. Saying, I'm going to stop. If I can remember and recall that I'm caught, I'm just going to stop. I'm just going to breathe. I'm just going to let some space in here. I'm going to say to myself, just because I'm thinking about it this way doesn't mean that it's true. Just that creates a huge amount of space around the problem that you're experiencing. So to create this kind of spaciousness in there, and to, one of the ways that we do that is that we see who we are, our tendencies. Reading this article about this comment here that Laura Vanderkamp made about being hardwired to be on constant alert and being negative. When I was writing my notes for this lecture, I thought about my mom. My mother was dead now, but she was a person who always saw the faults in everything. She'd go somewhere and she always would talk about what was wrong with the situation. And one time she told me, she said, well, it's not that I don't see the good in the situation, but it's not very interesting. So for her, it was far more interesting to take this kind of negative mindset to every situation and to point out what was wrong with it. And she would do this with her friends as well, you know. How she was perceived is as somebody who was constantly complaining, because she could never have an experience where she wasn't telling you about something that was wrong with it. And she was my mother. I didn't say to her, hey, Mom, could you say something nice about that? You know how you are with your parents. So she always saw things as problems. And, you know, people didn't like to be around her because she was so critical. She lived in a retirement community the last 10 years or so of her life. She was an amazing needlework. She could do amazing needlework. And her grandmother was a tailor. And so my mother was also a great sewer. And she also crocheted. She did all sorts of amazing stuff. She played great bridge, you know. She knew how to play mahjong. Yeah. lots of wonderful qualities, but the fact that she was so critical about every situation or the people that she was around was a real downer. It was a real downer for her, too. I don't think she realized... I think it was a real cause of suffering for her, and I don't think she even realized that it was a cause of suffering for her. So I think she was grateful about her life. I think if you had said to her, "Are you grateful? Have you had a good life?" she would have said, "I've had an amazing life. My dad was in the Air Force. He was stationed in Japan and Hawaii, and they were young, dashing, you know, a whack and a pilot during World War II. So my parents did lots of cool stuff and knew a lot of people. So if you asked her that, I'm sure she would have said that. And yet she was constantly going towards this place of this negative mindset. So I think it's important to remember that when we have a tendency towards this, that this is harmful to ourselves and others. So Shanti Deva is saying here, the verse is, the cause of happiness sometimes occur. The cause of happiness sometimes occur? I find that a very difficult statement, actually. I want to say, but wait. Surely we can be happier than that. And then he says the causes of suffering are many. So, becoming aware, how do we create he says, without suffering there is no renunciation, which is true. Suffering is usually what causes us to want to give up whatever it is that's creating problems. So if we're, addiction's a great example, if we're addicted to something, and we can be addicted to things other than drugs or food or whatever it is we might get caught on. We can just be addicted, like I feel like my mother was, to being negative all the time. We can be addicted to all sorts of things. So when we become aware of that, sometimes with addiction, what happens is that, you know, you have to hit rock bottom, right? There's this way in which it so much defines the nature of our experience that it seems to serve us well. So we create these kinds of ways of being that we think are helping us. Maybe we create them when we're kids. I was just reading about, somebody wrote in and said, my child throws huge temper tantrums at the supermarket. And because it's a public place, I tend to give into it and give my son what he wants. And the columnist wrote back and said, well, that's true, but of course, you're reinforcing for your son, who's not stupid, right? But at 2.5, all you want is what you want. You're not worried about Shantideva. You just want what you want. So if throwing a temper tantrum in the store gets you what you want, then you say to yourself, hey, that's kind of interesting. Maybe if I do it even better, bigger, you know, more often, I'll get what I want more often. And so, of course, what happens is that the son he's throwing bigger tantrums and getting what he wants out of that. So the columnist wrote back and said, well, you know, you're creating this pattern of behavior that's not very workable for you, but it actually works quite well for your son. And you're just going to have to deal with the fact that you're going to be in a store, and if you want to stop this behavior, you're going to have to stop doing what you're doing, and that's going to be probably pretty embarrassing for quite a while until your son figures out that he's not going to get what he wants. So there's this way in which we come up with these strategies in our lives that become totally unexamined. As we get older, they're kind of like just a matrix that we function with, similar to throwing the tantrum in the store, because they worked really well when we were 2.5. And they could be around our parents, they could be around many things, right? So this way in which I think it helps to try to look at, this is one of the things that therapy is really good for, Western psychological therapy is really good for this, is to kind of try to suss out those patterns. Buddhism is more like, you got a pattern? Okay, change.
Right.
You know, you got a pattern? It doesn't matter why you have the pattern. It doesn't matter, you know, what you've suffered when you were 3 or 4 years old. Change. Mm-hmm. And that's tough for us. That's difficult to do. But it is true that it is our suffering that brings us to renunciation, I think. It's our suffering that causes us to say, this is just not working, so I'm going to give this up. That's what renunciation is, right? It's giving something up. Most of the time when we think about renunciation, especially when we're younger, we think about some dramatic gesture that we're going to engage in. Like I remember when I first came to Zen practice, I said, I'm going to burn all my journals, and that was going to be my renunciation. Or I'm going to wear white all the time. That's my renunciation. Well, those things, they're okay, but you know, not being selfish is an awful lot harder to give up than your journals. Being generous is an awful lot harder to do than wearing white all the time. Wearing white all the time, you can feel really holy. You can feel very, very self-righteous about it. Or black all the time if you're a Zen student. So that what, you know, this renunciation, this giving up. Renunciation is also about giving up suffering. But at first, renunciation feels like suffering. It doesn't feel like you're giving up suffering. It feels like you're entering into suffering, even in a deeper way than you were before. So the way that we can motivate ourselves is by realizing how much suffering, and by the way, I'm not saying that you or I are creating suffering all the time. I'm saying talking about these kinds of issues that we get caught in, is realizing how much our suffering is causing, how much our unskillfulness is causing us suffering and others suffering as well. And when we start to deeply feel that in our bodies, like I really had to struggle a lot with anger. And a friend of mine said to me one time, he said, you know, he said, you're often right, but your delivery sucks. But while that might have been true, I couldn't see my anger. All I could see was that I was deeply, passionately involved in this, that, and the other thing. But I didn't perceive it as anger. But other people certainly perceived it as anger. And those people were really coming down on me hard. You know, this was at Tassajara. It was very painful. And I can remember crying about it a lot because it just felt so painful, like I was such a horrible person, you know. And then when you feel that, you don't want to change because you feel defensive. Rightfully so. You know, you feel like, wait a minute, I'm a good person. I have a big heart. You know, I really care. It's like, can it be that bad? And so this is the, for me, this was the beginning of really just being so floored by this. So I felt like I'd been knocked on the ground and my tongue was hanging out and I couldn't stand up. And the only thing I could figure out was, I guess you have to change. So I started reading Shanti Deva, started reading this chapter on patience. I guess you have to change. But I felt very defensive about it because I felt really criticized. Because people were not being skillful in the way they were relating to me. Unfortunately, when we make change, often people are not skillful. That just seems to be part of the territory. In my case, anyway. So people were not skillful, probably because they felt like they had to come down on me super, super hard because I either wasn't getting the message or because anger is a particular emotion that people are so frightened of that they just come blasting back at you, you know, with both barrels loaded. So anyway, I thought, well, okay, what's my deepest desire? my deepest desire was I actually wanted to be understood. I wanted to be communicate, right? So I kind of developed this intermediary strategy. So I'll tell this to you guys. So I'm saying that if you develop this intermediary strategy, I don't think it's a bad thing. So my strategy was to change so I could get what I wanted. Not change so that I could be a better person. Not change so that I would become a better practitioner or this more generous or more compassionate or empathic or anything like that. I was going to change because I wanted people to get what I was trying to say to them. And that because my methodology wasn't working, that I would tone it down. And I would come up with these various strategies. But here's what happened by doing that intermediary step, which was really hard because it meant changing in a way that was very difficult. But I couldn't see that kind of end game. I could only see this place here in the middle. So I started to change the way I was functioning in the situations that were problematic. And I started being heard and understood in a different way. What happened out of that, interestingly enough, was that by doing that kind of intermediary thing where I was doing it not for the other person, not for any kind of altruistic reasons, but just because I wanted something out of it, was I started to see how it was shifting and changing things, and then I started to want to do it for altruistic reasons. But I needed to do that intermediary step in there. So I don't think there's anything wrong with that, in a way. There's this way in which the part of you that's really doesn't want to change because it's so much a part of you, that part has to be your friend, right? You can't say, drive all blame into one, straighten up, fly right, because that part of you is going to go, what do you mean, straighten up, fly right? I'm a good person. I have a big heart. You know, I don't deserve this. I'm not going to listen to this. So there's this way in which this part of us just doesn't want to participate in its own demise, right? And I can understand that completely. And so we have to befriend that part of ourselves. We have to be sympathetic to that part of ourselves. And at the same time, we have to remember what it is that we, our deepest desire is, what our deepest practice is about. And that we can, and we have to feel our suffering. Because if we don't feel our suffering, we're not inclined to change. So that's part of this process of how we get to renunciation. This process of the desire. And who is it who wants to change? The part of ourselves from a Buddhist point of view that wants to change is our true nature, is our deepest Buddha nature. And what is Buddha nature? Buddha nature is a way to talk about, to personify our complete interconnected, inner penetration, lack of inherent existence with the totality of the universe, which is this big thought that is so kind of global and altruistic, it's really hard to relate to in a certain way. That's our true nature. And it is embodied in our particular personality and personage. It can only come about through the particularity of form. So that part of ourselves, which is already that, that is our essential nature. That part of ourselves, already there, completely developed, not even needing anything else, already happening, I think that's where our desire, deepest desire, comes from for change. That's the part of us that is crying out, you know, to alleviate our suffering. And yet, as Dogen says, traps and snares. Although he does say, traps and snares cannot catch us for long, right? So we become aware that we're causing harm to ourselves and others. We kind of hit rock bottom. And then we let go of the blaming, let go of our beating ourselves up, make it a workable problem, make it something that has some kind of spaciousness in it that cultivates for us the courage to change, the courage to make change in our lives, the desire to make change, the friendship of renunciation. To let go of our fixed views, to let go of our definitions of self. And then we do the practice. Then we find the things that encourage us in practice are outside of formal Buddhist practice. Whatever it is, you go to the beach, hang out with your best friends, chant, take your dog for a walk. These ways that we touch our bodies and minds deeply and soothe ourselves so that we can find that place where we are happy, where we feel full, and where we can be in that Dharma position, that we can recall and be in that Dharma position of freedom and liberation. So this is our practice. It's really hard. Buddhism is a very, very hard practice. If you do it, it's a hard practice. Because essentially, Buddhism is about renouncing and giving up our attachment to the selfish self, our attachment to no self means no inherently existing self. It doesn't mean that you do not have a self. We do have a self. We do have a particular personality. We do have individuality. And yet we are in these interconnected relationships. So no inherently existing self is the self that acknowledges that we function within a total mandala of our lives. And so Buddhism is saying, can we function in that mandala in the most skillful way with the least amount of suffering and be the most helpful that we can be? And in order to do that, we have to let go of a certain attachments to our notion of self. And that's like hitting us where we live. That is so hard to do. So hard to do. And sometimes we'll do it, we're fine, we don't think about it. Sometimes it feels like we're just pulling our teeth out. Sometimes it's really, really hard. And sometimes we don't even think about it. Personally, I think that as much as we can do this in a way that's wholesome for self and others, it's really a worthwhile practice. This is bodhisattva practice. And it isn't all about sort of a grim thing. It's not all grim. It's humorous. It's doing service and messing up and, you know, laughing about it and whatever. The cause of happiness sometimes occur, but the causes for suffering are very many. Without suffering, there is no renunciation. Therefore, mind, you should stand firm. So Shantideva is saying, please do the practice. Please stand firm. And I'll say, please stand firm with compassion. Please stand firm with empathy. Please stand firm with your discerning intelligence. Please encourage yourself. Please have faith in the practice. And yet, we can't do it without doing it. Thank you very much.